WHO and professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, as well as a professor of health policy and management at the Harvard School of Public Health. This series will be given a total of 8 times. Today is the second of the series, and it's being held every Wednesday, and in some countries it's early morning on Thursdays. To attend these sessions, you need to register for each one. The session is being recorded, and WHO Patient Safety will let you know the URL to download the presentation slides and the video later on. The next session will be conducted by Dr. Albert Wu from Johns Hopkins on April 14th, beginning at 1400 at GMT. Please note that the starting time is different from this session. If you have any questions later on, and we will be soliciting questions, please type them in the question section in English. We have not allowed the use of the microphone just because so many people are on. The questions you posed last time, we will respond to, and WHO Patient Safety will be creating the link to access that. So let's go ahead and get going. The goal today is to focus on the research aspect in patient safety. 5 important domains will be discussed in detail. Measuring harm, understanding causes, identifying solutions, evaluating impact, and translating evidence into safer healthcare. I'll start by talking about why research is needed. Then I'll go through a little bit of theory. I'll then give you a number of examples. That'll be the bulk of the time. We'll have an interactive period, and then we will wrap up. The theory in this area says that you need to start by beginning by measuring harm. If you do that, you get a picture of how much harm there is and what the main things are that are resulting in harm. You then often will want to do some additional work to understand the causes of that harm. The next step is identifying solutions. That's followed by evaluating impact. And then finally, our goal at the end of the day is to translate evidence into safer healthcare. And I'll be giving you examples of studies that focus on all those areas as we go along. There are 4 questions for Lecture 2, and you should think about the answers to these as we go through this, and I'll give you the answers at the end. The first question is, descriptive research is always better than inferential research, true or false? Next question is, when is doing qualitative research especially helpful? A, when you want to understand the reasons behind a safety issue. B, when you don't have enough resources to do a large prospective quantitative study. C, both A and B. D, neither A nor B. 3, when does it make most sense to do an observational research study? A is when the research, when the human subjects committee requires it. B is when the magnitude of a problem isn't known. C is when you want to find out whether or not a solution worked. And D is when you have tested a solution and found that it didn't work well. And finally and fourth, what is the strongest research design type? A is cross-sectional, B is survey, C is retrospective, and D is prospective. Next, I want to say a few words about descriptive research versus inferential research. Descriptive studies focus on describing phenomena in a specific sample of people, or describing the differences between 2 or more specific samples. When you do a descriptive study, you may find differences, but the question is often, what is the interpretation? Inferential studies, on the other hand, study specific samples of people in order to understand how phenomena operate in large groups of individuals. And these are generally more informative in patient safety than descriptive studies. An issue that comes up regularly is when to do qualitative versus quantitative research. And the relative advantages and disadvantages of each of these varied depending on the situation. In qualitative studies, your aim typically is to get a complete, detailed description of a particular problem. In a quantitative study, your aim is to count features and to build statistical models. When you do a qualitative study, you may only know roughly what you're looking for. In contrast, In a quantitative study, the researcher knows what they're looking for and is trying to sort out whether or not the difference that they are looking for is present. Qualitative studies are best done early on when you're trying to understand a phenomenon, whereas quantitative studies are best in the later phases. In qualitative studies, typically your data are in words, pictures, or objects, whereas in quantitative studies, the data are in numbers. Qualitative studies are rich, they're time-consuming, but they're less generalizable, and quantitative studies, in contrast, are more efficient and let you test hypotheses, but you may miss detail, which you could identify in a qualitative study. So when should you use a qualitative study versus a quantitative study? Well, typically you want to do qualitative work early on when you don't know what you're looking for. You want to do a quantitative study if you want numeric descriptions. Qualitative studies can be less expensive, substantially less expensive, and you can often, for example, get a good sense of what the safety issues in an organization are or a part of an organization are with this. An example would be if you sit down with some of the leaders in an organization and ask them what they believe the key safety issues are in their organization. But the data that you get from this are less likely to be persuasive to leadership than a quantitative study. However, I want to note that the two approaches are often complementary, and that's especially true in evaluation of interventions. The quantitative part of an evaluation of an intervention tells you whether or not the intervention worked. But the qualitative part, if you do that, can tell you why or why not, and that's often just as important as whether it worked. Especially for interventions that did not work, it's really useful to know why not. Next, I want to talk about observational research versus interventional research. And observational research is the sort of research that you typically want to do first. And what you're trying to do is to understand a safety problem, the specific frequency of problems, and perhaps some of the potential approaches for addressing them. Observational studies can help you get a sense of what the ceiling is for the benefit of an intervention. An example would be doing a study at one hospital to identify adverse events so that you can decide what group of adverse events to work on first. You might be thinking about working on infections versus working on problems caused by drugs or surgical complications. Interventional studies are most useful for testing a solution, and usually you have an intervention and a control group, although there are various designs, and you can do a before-after study in the same group, so not having any control group. You can also do an off-on or on-off study in which you start with a control period, implement an intervention, turn it off for a bit, and then turn it on again. And you can also have a contemporaneous control sort of approach. One example of an interventional study would be studying the surgical checklist in half the surgical services in an organization. That would give you a sense of how well the surgical checklist was working. The three main types of design are cross-sectional, retrospective, and prospective. In a cross-sectional study, you're taking a single cut at one time through a population, and you count the number of adverse events in a hospital, for example, in one day. In a retrospective study, you typically are taking a population and then looking back through a specific period. An example would be reviewing all the deaths for a year in an organization. In a prospective study, you're looking forward for a specific period. And an example there would be counting all hospital-acquired infections looking forward with active surveillance over a year. Next, I'm going to take you through some actual case examples of classic studies that have been performed. One study was done by Ross Baker et al., which looked at measuring harm. And the goal of this study was to estimate the incidence of adverse events among patients in Canadian acute care hospitals. The methods that they used was to randomly select one teaching, one large community, and two small community hospitals in each of five provinces in Canada. So they had a large had really a representative sample from different provinces, and then they reviewed a random sample of charts for adult patients in each of those hospitals in one fiscal year. They train reviewers to have them screen all the eligible charts, and physicians reviewed the positively screened charts to identify the adverse events and determine preventability. The adverse event rate came out to be 7.5 per 100 hospital admissions, and among hospitals with adverse events, the preventable events represented 37% of the adverse events. Death occurred in 20.8%, and they estimated that 1,521 additional hospital days were associated with these adverse events. The overall incidence rate of adverse events suggested that of the almost 2.5 million annual hospital admissions in Canada, about 185,000 are associated with an adverse event, and a close to 70,000 are potentially preventable. So that's the big picture summary. Now we'll go into a little more detail. We've provided for each of these studies links to the abstract and then links to the full text PDF, which you'll be able to get to later if you download these presentations. So to go through this study then in more detail, the definition of adverse events that they used were unintended injuries or complications resulting in death, disability, or prolonged hospital stay that arise from healthcare management. And that was based on the medical practice study definition of an adverse event, which is the one that's been most widely used. There now have been prevalent studies like this one in a number of countries. The investigators believe that the rate of adverse events among hospital patients is an important indicator of patient safety. And there have been a number of studies which have been done at the time that they did this. Hospital chart reviews have revealed adverse event rates between 2.9 and 16.6% of patients in acute care hospitals. But there was no large Canadian study when this study was done, so it was very helpful in persuading the policy leaders in Canada that this is an important issue. In other studies, 37 to 51% of adverse events had been judged to be potentially preventable, but that proportion varies from place to place, and the investigators wanted to look at this in more detail, again in Canada, so that they would have a local context. The rationale, again, for doing the study was that there had been several U.S. studies which indicated that substantial harm can result from care, but the Canadian policymakers were reluctant to generalize those results to Canada. And in particular, the Tuer's Human Report, despite the fact that it was very persuasive in the United States, had very little impact on Canadian healthcare policymakers and systems leaders. And there was very little in the way of Canadian data on adverse events in hospital patients. And that made the investigators realize that local data was needed. When the reviewers went through the charts, they found adverse events in a total of 255 charts. And they then built up a weighted adverse event rate of 7.5 per 100 medical or surgical hospital admissions. And they weighted to extrapolate to the full sample of the population. The weighted preventable adverse event rate was similar across all three hospital types. More than a third of the adverse events were judged to be highly preventable. 9% of the deaths associated with an adverse event were judged to be preventable. And most of the patients who experienced an adverse event recovered without permanent disability, but a substantial chunk did result in disability. 5.2% resulted in permanent disability, and 59.9% resulted in death. In addition, it was clear that patients who experienced adverse events experienced longer hospital stays than those without adverse events, and overall, adverse events led to an additional 1,521 hospital days. The rate of adverse events varied among different types of services, so 51% occurred in patients getting surgical care, 45% occurred in patients getting medical care. The most common cause of these were drug and fluid-related events, and only 3.6% occurred with other services. Men and women experienced equal rates of adverse events, and patients who had adverse events were significantly older than those who did not. The authors were asked later to look back and provide lessons and advice for people who are going into research in patient safety. And they said that if one thing in the study could have been done differently, they would have spent more time training data collectors, and they would have trained everyone at once with roughly three days of training. And I would say this is something that has come up before in studies that I've done too. That really makes a lot of sense. If your data collectors are not collecting data in exactly the way that you want them to, it's hard to interpret the results later on. They also wish that they'd implemented web-based data collection, and that's been done in a number of studies subsequently, and I think it just really makes a lot of sense today. This was done a few years ago, but now there's really no reason not to use web-based data collection. Their advice to young researchers would be to find important questions first, and that, again, makes a lot of sense. Because it takes just as long to answer an unimportant question as it does to answer an important one. In addition, they were asked to comment on feasibility and applicability in developing countries. And this, of course, will depend some on the quality of documentation in patient files and the availability of experienced researchers and project managers. But doing a study like this is feasible if good quality medical records are available. And in general, it's possible to train people, I think, in nearly every country to do this if a country wants to make a serious effort in this area. The authors were also asked what barriers did they have to overcome. And they did a few things to try and ensure success. One was to train provincial data collectors together to help ensure that each provincial team applied the methods in a consistent fashion. In addition, they automated the data collection template to try and improve reliability and facilitate remote transfer of data to a secure computer server. Furthermore, they created a series of test charts to help ensure reliability after the training and before data collection began. And finally, they monitored the data collection closely and reviewed the results from each team, or even worked with local reviewers to try and improve the data collection procedures. When you're doing a study like this and you find a problem with data collection, it's just very important to jump on it early. And it's important to look as you're going along to see if problems are occurring. The next study that I want to go through relates to understanding causes. So here the situation is you've done a study, you've established that there is a problem, but you want to understand why it's going on. And this is a study by Andrews et al. Their objective was to enhance understanding of the incidence and scope of adverse events as a basis for preventing them. And they performed a prospective observational study in which they analyzed discussion of adverse events during the care of all patients admitted to 3 units at a large teaching hospital. They did this by having ethnographers attend regularly scheduled meetings of healthcare providers and record and classify all adverse events discussed. Of the 1,047 patients who were studied, 185, or nearly 18%, had at least one serious adverse event. And these were more frequent in patients with higher severity of underlying illness. Patients with long stays in hospital also had more adverse events, and the likelihood of an adverse event increased about 6% for each day of hospital stay. They concluded that there's a wide range of potential causes of adverse events, and the particular attention has to be paid to errors with interactive or administrative causes. They also believe that healthcare providers' own discussion of their adverse events can be a good source of data for proactive error prevention. So here again are the links to the abstract and the full text PDF. And the study was from The Lancet. To go through things in more detail, their idea here was to enhance the understanding of the incidence of adverse events as a basis for preventing them. And they noted that the data on the frequency of adverse events related to inappropriate care in hospitals often comes from medical records, but chart analyses alone may be inadequate to determine the frequency of adverse events. And doctors, in this instance, alerted the research team to high levels of errors in hospitals and described large numbers of errors that were not being recorded in patients' records. The study was a prospective observational ethnographic study, and the ethnographers recorded adverse events incidentally mentioned at regularly scheduled meetings and then developed a classification scheme to code the data. Their objectives were to do a study of potential adverse events in hospitalized patients and to assess the incidence, cause, and response to error, and to develop a deeper understanding of adverse events than what may be available in after-the-effect analysis of medical records and prospective studies examining particular procedures. This was done in three units at a large tertiary care urban hospital in the U.S. During the study, there were 1,047 patients in the three units. A third of them were admitted more than once for a total of 1,716 admissions. The population that was studied included attending surgeons, physicians, fellows, residents, interns, nurses, and other healthcare providers on 10 surgical services. The data were actually collected by four ethnographers who'd been trained in qualitative observational research, and they chronicled the discussion of adverse events, which were held at regular meetings. Each of these ethnographers was given a month of additional training to enable them to carry out field work in a medical setting, and they recorded all information about all adverse events and patient care mentioned at these meetings. They didn't ask questions or make any clinical judgments. And during the nine-month period, the ethnographers observed the things that people do regularly in healthcare. So they observed attending physician rounds, residence work rounds, nursing shift changes, case conferences, and additional scheduled meetings in three study units, as well as departmental and sectional meetings. They found that patients were evenly distributed by sex and race, and that the source of payment was generally representative of the national distribution in the U.S. Of the patients in the studies, nearly 18% experienced a serious event that led to longer hospital stay and increased costs to patients. 37.8% of adverse events they said were caused by an individual. 15.6% had interactive causes, and 9.8% were due to administrative decisions. The highest proportion of adverse events, or 29.3%, occurred during postoperative monitoring in care versus during surgery itself. And a lot of the prior focus has been on what happens in surgery, and that actually may not be the most important time. In addition, only 1.2%, or 13% of patients experiencing adverse events made claims for compensation. So a very small proportion of people sued. The occurrence of the initial adverse event was linked to the seriousness of the patient's underlying illness, and patients who had long stays had more adverse events than those with short stays. The likelihood of experiencing an adverse event increased about 6% for each day of hospital stay, and it was broadly unaffected by differences in ethnicity, gender, payer class, or age. So the authors again were asked to reflect, and they said that if they could have done something differently, they would fund greater distribution of the results and also a follow-up study on how to use them to improve care. For researchers, they suggested that researchers should work closely in the development of healthcare facilities to ensure that research on incidence of errors is considered from the beginning. They also believe that their study was easily adaptable to various settings, and said that such a study could be undertaken by one observer, for example, trained in participant observation with a computer and a statistics program. The next study I want to go through focuses on identifying solutions, and this comes from Reggiori et al. And was done in a district rural hospital in Uganda, where they looked at 850 patients who were evaluated prospectively over a three-year period. The question that they asked was, is conventional postoperative penicillin therapy with single They wanted to compare two strategies, the conventional postoperative penicillin therapy with single-dose ampicillin prophylaxis for hernia repair and ectopic pregnancy, and the comparison was with a single-dose ampicillin and metronidazole prophylaxis for hysterectomy and C-section. They found high rates of postoperative infection after conventional treatment with penicillin. And when they went to the new regimen, this was significantly reduced. Length of stay and postoperative mortality rates also fell. And they also, they concluded that single-dose ampicillin prophylaxis with or without metronidazole, even though these are rarely used today in developing countries, were more cost-effective than standard penicillin treatment. Here's the link to the abstract. In this instance, we could not provide a link to the full text, but you can get it at the URL that's described. So the reason that the authors were interested in this area was that postoperative wound and deep infection is a really major concern in developing countries. In sub-Saharan Africa, the records of postoperative infections are rare. There have been few formal studies. Nonetheless, infection rates as high as 40 to 70% have been observed. Poor conditions in hospitals can contribute to the high rate of postoperative infection. So there are issues with poor sterility and hygiene of operating theaters and wards. There's lack of trained personnel. Emergency surgical procedures are often performed on patients who present late in the course of their illness. The design that they picked was a randomized controlled trial, and they did that because they believed it was the strongest design. And their objectives were to compare the clinical effectiveness of conventional post-operative penicillin therapy with a single-dose ampicillin prophylaxis for these conditions. They also compared the clinical effectiveness of conventional post-operative penicillin therapy with single-dose ampicillin metronidazole prophylaxis for hysterectomy and C-section. And then they measured the impact of different regimes on factors such as duration of post-op stay and costs of care. They found big reductions for all four areas. So for after hernia repair, the infection rate fell from 7.5% to 0%. For ectopic pregnancy, it fell from 10.5% to 2.4%. After hysterectomy, from 20 to 3.4%. And after C-section, from 38.2% to 15.2% infections. Patients who got ampicillin also had significant reductions in length of stay, postoperative mortality rates, and postoperative complications for patients who had invasive surgeries, specifically hysterectomy and cesarean section. The average cost for an admission day at Hoima Hospital, which is the hospital studied, was US$3, including personnel costs, drug supplies, and utilities. And they saw cost savings with the new regimes. And ampicillin metronidazole regimens were cheaper than the full penicillin course, and duration of a postoperative stay was shorter for both groups of patients receiving ampicillin prophylaxis. They concluded that postoperative infection rates in developing countries are often underestimated and undocumented, but despite that, high postoperative infection rates can be significantly reduced, even with settings with resource constraints. They also believe that this study showed that antibiotic prophylaxis with ampicillin is effective in reducing the postoperative mortality rate in clean general surgery and in GYN operations, and that single-dose ampicillin prophylaxis, again, though it's rarely used in developing countries, is more effective than the standard penicillin treatment. When they were asked to reflect on this, they said that they face challenges changing the behavior and habits of paramedical staff who are used to doing things the same way. And they convinced them by showing them that the infection rate was really different between the two regimes and that their work could be made easier. They were also asked if the research is feasible and applicable in other developing countries, and they believe that it's applicable everywhere because it's really simple, and the result is to simplify patient care. There was no technology or anything sophisticated in terms of care that was involved. With respect to future research, they suggested trying always to find new ways to improve patient care, and don't be satisfied with what you know already. Learn from others. And for future research projects, they recommended analyzing the importance of human factors, such as doctors and nurses, et cetera, in patient care, and to identify the most crucial aspects. Next study is a study that we did. I was the first author that focused on the costs of adverse events in hospitalized patients. This is on evaluating impact. And the backdrop here is that due to the ongoing economic crisis in U.S. hospitals at the time, and one that's still going on today, only cost-effective quality improvement efforts are likely to be pursued. So to reduce the costs of adverse drug events, you first have to know what the cost of the events is. Our research team wanted to be able to justify investing in interventions to reduce adverse drug event frequency. The backdrop here is that there is a lot of skepticism around this, especially on the part of chief financial officers and organizations, who are the ones who typically you have to get to buy in. The design we used here was a cost analysis using a nested control study within a prospective cohort study. And we'd already done the prospective cohort study. Incidents were detected by self-report by nurses and pharmacists in chart review, and they were classified as to whether or not they mapped to an adverse drug event. Data on length of stay and charges were obtained from billing data, and estimated costs were targeted for analysis. We used three methods of data collection: passive. Nurses and pharmacists reported incidents. Active, so nurse investigators solicited information from personnel regarding adverse drug events twice daily. And finally, chart review, so nurse investigators reviewed the charts daily. The types of data that we collected included the usual sorts of things, so demographics, ensure impact of adverse drug event during hospitalization. Outcome variables included length of stay and total charges. The length of stay we found increased by 2.2 days for all adverse drug events and 4.6 days for all preventable adverse drug events. And the total costs increased by $3,244 for all adverse drug events and by nearly $6,000 for preventable adverse drug events. The net was that there are substantial costs of adverse drug events to hospitals, and our hope was that this would provide incentives for hospitals to invest in efforts to prevent these events. The estimates found in this study are conservative because they don't include the costs of injuries to patients or malpractice costs, neither of which are usually included in studies of this type. We also felt that hospitals could use these figures to justify devoting additional resources to develop systems to reduce the number of preventable adverse drug events. And that intervention in this area not only improve patient care, but also reduce adverse drug event-related expenses. The study has had a big impact, and it's been very widely used. So what lessons do we have? Well, one is that if you're doing a primary epidemiologic study of patient safety, it's worth considering adding an economic evaluation. The expensive part in doing a study like this is really in finding the adverse events. It doesn't cost that much to add on a bit like this. Second, there's a serious lack of data on these sorts of costs in different countries and settings, and more data is desperately needed. And we're hoping that some of the people who are on this call will go on to do work that's like this. In addition, this kind of work is especially needed for developing countries in which resources tend to be scarce. And it's not impossible to do a study like this. I just shared with you this study from Uganda. This kind of research is feasible anytime a group is collecting primary data about adverse events and you have access to costs or resource use. But I will note that combination is not an easy one to identify. Many times when you can get data about adverse events, it's hard to get data about the costs or resource utilization. Next, I want to talk about translating evidence into practice. And here the example I'll use is clean care, is safer care. And I talked about this last week, so I'm not going to go into it in great detail. But the safe practice is hand washing using alcohol-based hand rub, and that's been shown to be effective. And here the instance was, the issue is not so much to show that it works, but to get really large groups of people all over the world to actually implement this safe practice. And the effort overall has been extremely successful. So this slide shows the field testing of the WHO guidelines on hand hygiene in healthcare between 2006 and 2008. And round dots are complementary sites. The large squares are pilot sites, and there have been pilots that have been carried out in all main parts of the world, but in countries like Italy and Costa Rica and Mali and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and Bangladesh, as well as China and Hong Kong. And as you can see, their complementary sites really are just covering much of the whole planet. There could still be more, for example, in many parts of Africa, and in some other regions. But this has just been overall an extremely successful effort, and the results clearly show that hand hygiene compliance has improved substantially in pilot sites. So, for example, in Costa Rica, the rate went up from 39% to 69%. In Mali, where it started out at 8%, it went up to 22%. In Saudi Arabia, it went from 45% first to 59%, but then later to 85%. And you can see really quite large increments for many of the countries that have been evaluated. So next, what I'm going to ask you to do is to start thinking about what reports, what research projects you're currently involved in or considering, and you can go ahead and type in a brief description of those and any questions you have about them. I'm going to finish the talking part of this, and then I will come back and answer your questions, but you can go ahead and start writing things in now. The references I would suggest you look at include a primer from Hulley et al. That talks about designing clinical research and epidemiological approach. There's a series of four papers from Quality and Safety in Healthcare by Brown et al. Published in 2008, which is terrific. And there are also full descriptions of many more classical research studies on the World Alliance website, and I've given you the URL for that. So to wrap up, there are these five key domains in patient safety research. And when you pick a study type, it will depend on the domain. It will also depend on the resources that are available. Qualitative and quantitative studies, I want to emphasize, are both valuable. And you sometimes might even want to do put a qualitative component with a quantitative study. I talked about when to do each of these. We also need more evaluations of solutions in particular. But you often have to define a problem in a particular setting. If you do have data like that, that can help you get to action. So let's go through the answers for lecture two. First of all, descriptive research is always better than inferential research. That's false. When is doing qualitative research especially helpful? Answer is C, both A and B. Question three, when does it make sense to do an observational research study? The answer is B, when the magnitude of a problem is not known. You want to do an interventional study if you're evaluating a solution, for example. The strongest research design type is a prospective study. So I'm now going to go to the part of things where I go through and answer questions. And I will start doing that now. All right, so I'm going to hand the presenter back to WHO and take a look at the questions. So, okay. So an example of a prospective study would be a study in which you look to see how many patients in your institution have an adverse event over a specific period, say a 3-month period. The next question is, are there studies on patient safety in a community setup? And there are quite a number of these. An example would be studies like the Canadian study that I told you, which basically included a number of organizations from a broad area in Canada. Now they were looking in particular at hospitals. There's not been as much research done in primary care on patient safety as there should be. And that is definitely something that we need more of. I don't think any of the examples that I included today took place outside the hospital, but there have been many studies like that, and I think Dr. Wu will be talking about some. Another question was, is there any specific source for more reading in patient safety for psychiatric studies? And I think here, if you just do a PubMed search, you'll find some studies. We actually did one of the largest studies, which was done by Rothschild et al. Rothschild is R-O-T-H-S-C-H-I-L-D, and I'm a co-author too. So if you use one of the search approaches, a number of the studies in psychiatric settings are referred to in that paper. The next question comparing different types of adverse drug event detection methods to find a pragmatic method. There have been some very good papers written comparing the different approaches for finding adverse drug events. One study was published by Morimoto, and I'm a co-author on that one, in which Morimoto Dr. Takeshi Morimoto describes the relative pros and cons of different approaches for finding those. And I agree that's an important issue. Next comment is that in Indian hospitals, the practice of surgeons moving around in OT uniforms near reception and outpatient areas is a common feature, and that postoperative infections may go unnoticed. That's a big issue actually in many parts of the world, and the commenter suggested a possible initiative from WHO to educate doctors. I mean, that would be an option. I'd say the first thing that you should do is try a local intervention, and see whether or not you might be able to do something locally that would make a difference. C. Lee asks, what's the role of voluntary incident reporting systems in measuring and improving patient safety? Here what I would say is that the role is really to get a qualitative sense of what near misses are going on. Turns out that voluntary approaches are not as good at finding adverse events as prospective studies, so you just can't get a very good sense of what's going on from a quantitative perspective if you do not do a study like the Baker study that I mentioned, or a prospective study looking forward. The second question that Dr. Lee asked was, in addition to the qualitative analysis of individual incident reports, what research methodologies could we apply to extract the maximum amount of useful information? And that's an interesting question, and one that is still being evaluated. Safael Kous writes that they're doing a retrospective study in Ministry of Health hospitals where they're looking at 4,400 records, and there the rate of adverse events was 2.5%. Margarita Eras asks, "What is a serious adverse event?" And there are a variety of different classification systems for severity of adverse events. We have not talked about that yet. I suspect Dr. Wu will get into severity of adverse events, but it depends a little bit on which scheme you use, and there are several different ones. Dr. Mohammed asks about how chart review is done for adverse events. Typically, the way that's done is that the reviewers are given a set of of specific things to look for, like that the patient decompensated and needed to go to a different care setting, or that they developed a new rash. And so they're looking through the record, looking for one of these specific problems. If one of those is found, then it's noted. The chart is written up, and then additional reviewers basically go through and see whether or not that they agree that that these things are actually adverse events. Bill Geary Sutler asks, how does a patient get to know of an adverse drug event to claim insurance? And patients often only find out about whether or not they had an adverse event if the providers tell them. And it is important for providers to disclose to patients when an adverse event has occurred. Josiah Farris asks if I can explain a cohort study, and I will. Cohort studies are basically a cohort of individuals is when you find all the people who have had really the same exposure. So an exposure could be getting admitted to the hospital. It could be being seen in one particular clinic. If you're doing a clinical study, you might study, for example, the cohort of all the patients who came to the clinic who had tingling fingers. In safety instances, it's usually you're looking at everyone who got admitted to the hospital in, say, March, April, or May, and you look to see whether or not they had a problem. Alex Oliveira asks, how can I make sure that my evidence will be accepted in the hospital that I work in? And that's one of the toughest questions of all. I think that the things that you can do is to make sure that you use good methodology when you did the study, that you picked the right design type. And then when you present the results, you want to make the presentation really clear and targeted at whatever the main issues are of the specific administrators. Joanne Zaborowski asks, after 10 years after Air2Air is human, is patient safety really any better? And that's a great question. We still don't actually know the answer to that. We do know that a lot more research has been done in patient safety. And accumulating evidence does suggest actually that the care is beginning to get substantially safer. It took a while to basically go through the cycle that I talked about today. And we now have a number of interventions that are highly effective. Many of them are focused on reducing infection rates. Others are focused on reducing the frequency of harm from drugs. Others are focused on falls. There's still others on pressure ulcers. But you know, one of the biggest issues is how do you spread that kind of information? And another thing that we need is better metrics for measuring how we're doing with respect to safety in an ongoing way. Ibrahim Oriagbi asks, how do you determine that an adverse event is preventable or not, which is a great question, and I think Dr. Wu is also going to go into that. Typically, the index that you use is there any error that's identified that independent observers can agree was an error in the circumstances preceding the event? An example would be if a patient gets penicillin and they develop a bad reaction to it. Well, if they've never had penicillin before and they got the bad reaction, they were harmed by the penicillin, but it's not preventable. If, on the other hand, you knew that they had an allergy to the penicillin, but you gave them the penicillin anyway, then that would be a preventable adverse event. Isabella Castro asks, says that she's from a Brazilian hospital that's being accredited by JCI, and and makes asks about how do you show that a particular approach is financially good to the hospital and not just for patients? And that's why I'm talking about doing some of the financial analyses that we mentioned. When you do that, you can make the case to administrators successfully that that it is really good for everyone. I think that the kinds of she also asked what kinds of indicators do you think are best to show financial improvement, and I think it's really to show that you have a solution that's effective, and then you can do an analysis to look to see what an adverse event costs in your setting, and how much it costs to prevent that event. We're actually doing an evaluation now in which we're trying to project the global burden of patient safety events. And those results, when they're complete, will be available to everyone, and they won't be exactly right for every country because we don't have wonderful economic data from every country in the world. But I think they'll be a very helpful starting point, and they'll be very useful for making this kind of argument. So the hour is late. It's 3:00. I want to thank everybody. We will try and get through the rest of the questions offline. But thank you again for attending this second session. The next session will be next week. Again, it will be given by Dr. Wu. It will be at a different time. And thank you again for attending today. Take care.